Hello, everybody. Welcome to this edition of Positively Autistic Jeanette's Autism Show. This show is auspiced through the wonderful people at Positively Autistic in the UK who do great work around autism advocacy and promoting understanding and respect and all of those good things. I'm very lucky that they asked me to do this show a couple of years ago, and I've been doing it ever since, and it's really wonderful. If you have not come across me before, my name's Jeanette Purkis. I'm an autistic self-advocate located in Australia. I have a little black kitty called Mr. Kitty. He's very important. I do a lot of writing, books, blogs, all that kind of thing, advocacy, public speaking, and all those sorts of things. And one of the things I love doing is getting authors on the show to talk about their own books and their areas of expertise. So today, we're very fortunate to have an excellent friend and colleague of mine, Trevor Clark, who's written a book called Exploring Giftedness and Autism. So welcome, Trevor.
Hi, many thanks for inviting me, Jeanette. I'm delighted to be here today.
Excellent, I'm pretty happy too. Can you tell the listeners a bit about you and your interests and what you do and things like that?
Yeah, about myself. My title has changed very recently. I work for ASPECT, Autism Spectrum Australia, and I had been for at least 16 years the National Director for Education. So by background, I'm a teacher. I'm one of those dreadful people that flew across the ditch from New Zealand many years ago, a Kiwi refugee. And, I arrived in this country as a special education teacher. And within about one year of actually moving to Sydney, it was right back in the 80s, I ended up working for ASPECT as a casual teacher. Many, many years later, I'm now my current role, which is the National Director for Research, and also a grand title, a Senior Education Consultant.
Wow, that sounds incredibly important. Although I know with job titles, sometimes it's hard to tell just what's being said in the title. But I do know you're very senior and very knowledgeable in your work. And you've actually written this book, Exploring Giftedness and Autism, which was published last year. Could you tell us a little bit about the book?
Yes, the book, as you said, the title, Exploring Giftedness and Autism, published last year, was published by Routledge in the UK. The real reason, Jeanette, I did decide to take that step and write, it's the first book I've written, was really, I guess, a lot of encouragement over a number of years from some very important people in my life. One of those is Dr. Daryl Treffert, who's a psychiatrist who lives in Fond du Lac in Wisconsin, who really is, I guess, the world's father of savant syndrome. He actually coined the definition. And the book is based on my original doctoral thesis, which I undertook early 2000 at the University of New South Wales. For many years, Daryl, he was one of the examiners of my thesis. So it was Temple Grandin, an examiner of my thesis, and also America Gross, who used to be, I guess, Australia's most preeminent person in the field of gifted education. The influence of those three people, many years harping on to me, Trevor, have you written that book yet? I guess gave me the prompt, but probably that's the personal reason. Probably more from where I sit in the field of autism. I think the book portrays a very, I guess, important perspective on autism. That's looking at the strengths, interests, and the sometimes the very exceptional abilities of both children, and I'm talking very young children. Some of the children my original study were 4 years of age on the spectrum with incredible specialist skills, all the way up to adults. So really they are the two reasons. Lots of encouragement by wonderful people in the field and also outside the field, in the field of gifted education. And also really I just thought it was very timely to publish with a very positive message. And I guess, the rationale for that is that my belief is that many people on the spectrum do have special strengths and interests, and it's up to us, parents, educators, professionals, to support those skills that they might excuse me, my voice is running out already, we've only started, that they may be able to use those skills post-school as they move into adult life. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just talking about for vocational skills, mm-hmm. jobs. I'm also talking about leisure and recreation, mm-hmm. so that people can have, you know, a fulfilled life.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting from my personal perspective, because I certainly don't have any savant skills, which should get you to define at some point. Oh, yes, there we go, next question. But I definitely have some twice exceptional giftedness skills, mainly around creativity and particularly around writing and public speaking, you know, presenting to an audience and stuff, structuring ideas and concepts clearly, explaining things. I remember at uni, I was puzzled by all my colleagues because they'd be freaking out about their essays. And I'd say, well, you just do the research and write the thing. How is it hard? And they all looked at me like I was got two heads or something. But I do know with my writing, it takes a lot longer to actually type it. The ideas are there. The ideas are fully formed in my head, or they're embryonic and they can become fully formed in my head. I download it from the brain onto the laptop. It's not the actual writing. The difficulty in writing for me is the physical act of typing and correcting errors, and I get very frustrated that I can't just actually literally download it from brain into computer. But, yeah, I definitely have those skills, which are indeed very good in my paid work, but also in my what I do for enjoyment, which is this sort of thing. Just for the book, who was the intended audience for this? Was it aimed at clinicians, at people themselves on the spectrum, at parents, anything like that?
First and foremost, I would actually say, well, people on spectrum, and that includes, you know, people like yourself, adults, autistic adults, who may, you know, have the ability to read and comprehend, understand some of the concepts in the book. But I must say, primarily, I would say it was for parents, number one, teachers, secondly, and, you know, allied health professionals, therapists, psychologists, and those, you know, undertaking tertiary studies in autism. The reason I say parents is because for many years I was very fortunate that Daryl Treffert, I mentioned him before, you know, the world's lead in savant syndrome, he posted my work on his website. So I would say for at least 10, 12 years I've received many emails around the world from parents every other week. You know, it's a different part of the world. A parent asking, explaining the exceptional skills of their children, and I'm talking sometimes again, you know, preschool age, 3, 4, 5, and also listening to their frustration about when they've spoken to their preschool teacher or their child's teacher and the message isn't being received well. So often the parents feel ignored, that, you know, they're making up, you know, these ideas about their children's abilities. And so that was, I guess I felt the frustration of many of those parents. And again, you know, I would try and respond and, you know, suggest ways and ideas that they could educate their teachers or the preschool teachers and, you know, passing on excerpts from my thesis and screeners and strategies, etc. But that was the other reason, because I'd done that for many years. And also for teachers, Jeanette, I thought, hang on a minute, just step back, put it in a book so it's accessible to everyone that might, you know, need support, need ideas about these particular abilities of, you know, and I'm not going to say some, I'm going to say many actually display on the spectrum.
Oh, definitely, definitely. Now, your book obviously looks at giftedness and savant skills among autistic people, and you use a term that I hadn't come across before, which was paradox children. What do you mean by that?
I guess I used that term, Jeanette, and you did touch on it just before when we were talking. Really, it refers to students who are gifted in a particular area of performance, but also have a diagnosed disability. Yeah. Okay, I guess what was unique, really, again, about the thesis, and it was by accident. I was finishing a master's at New South Wales University. My whole career, my whole life has been focused on supporting children with disabilities, special needs. And just for interest, I thought, I'm going to do one topic, one course on gifted education. And there I was very fortunate to meet, and in the field of gifted education, they call it a chance factor. Whereas sometimes in life, it's necessarily what you know, may not be your high intelligence or any other skill, but by chance, you are fortunate to meet someone who acts as a mentor facilitator in your life. America did that for me. And really, I was very lucky because I learned a lot about a non-disabled gifted children, how do you identify them, and what should teachers be using to support gifted children in their classrooms. At the time, Jeanette, I was teaching one of my first classes of children with autism when I first joined ASPECT many years ago in a very small school in Kingsgrove in Sydney. And I had the fortune of teaching a young boy, and I'm going to give him a pseudonym, Patrick, who's in my book, who has 8 discrete savant abilities. And, of course, I was his teacher, and I felt I was failing to meet his learning needs. And so by looking into the field of gifted education was really to try and support Patrick. And so his individual education plan started to look more like a plan for a non-disabled gifted student. And it was, I guess, coming together of the field of autism, coming together the field of gifted education, that something clicked and just seemed really appropriate. And then I went on to do my doctorate and develop a whole study, which was an educational curriculum, which is what this book is all about. You know, how do you identify savant skills in children on the spectrum? Secondly, how do you differentiate the curriculum or your program to include, to cater to those particular special skills? And sorry, I'm rabbiting on, aren't I? I've moved from the paradox. So it's giftedness plus disability. In the field of gifted education, and you did use the term, they refer to children with those two aspects, and the one child as twice exceptional students. So that means one exceptionality, of course they're gifted. So any mainstream child that's classified as gifted, it's quite a unique exceptionality. The second exceptionality is, of course, they have a diagnosed disability. And I don't think until I'd written the book and re-looked at the literature that we've actually brought this term, twice exceptional, into the field of autism. I think it's really appropriate. And I guess before you were describing some of your own high levels of performance, Jeanette, and you know I've discussed and talked about at this at conferences, but, you know, I think there's a group, twice exceptional people on the autism spectrum, those who are high academic or intellectual performance. I'm talking to one, Jeanette Perkis is one of those. And she's just
the scary intellect of Jeanette, yes, and wisdom now too, and insight. So I'm very frightening, yes, I can't talk to myself even.
Important, you know, for many years, you know, we're focused, I guess, on the deficit, on the impairments of autism, without actually looking what are the exceptional skills, and for some of our population, very highly gifted people who in their own area of performance that they excel at can do extremely well, and just as you have done, Jim.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, actually, because I look at my, I'm not going to talk about my personal history at any length here, this is your show, but somebody to come out of that really difficult time that I had when I was in my 20s and teens, I always used to think, oh, I'm not anything special, you know, anyone could have done it. And then I think, actually, it's not that I'm, you know, I haven't consciously been wonderful, but actually I think that intellect and that ability to assimilate new information and to have talents that translated into employment and things like that and accomplishments, I'm really happy about that. I think you just answered my next couple of questions, which is excellent. I love this. You did. For the listeners, I have a list of questions, but I tend to be fairly hands-off in how I apply them. They're just a guide, so it's always nice to see where things got done. So one thing, we talked about the excellent sort of skills and talents and positives of having savant skills or twice exceptional experience. Are there any challenges that are specific to that group, though?
That's an interesting question, Jeanette. And when I was working, I mentioned before a young boy, Patrick, who had 8 discrete savant abilities. In actual fact, that little boy, he was a little Italian boy, 8 years of age when I started to work with him. And Patrick, I guess, in some ways, was an extremely challenging student. Number one, I think... those who do have savant skills or may fall in the twice exceptional, fully gifted range, like many gifted children, are bored. Bored in their education program, bored with their home environments. And that was my sense, and it was a great challenge to Patrick. He spent all his time trying to escape my little classroom, looking for encyclopedias, books to read. And I do describe one example where Patrick escaped out of the classroom window. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I'm talking about a very small three-bedroom brick and tile house. That was mm-hmm. one of our founding schools. He went out the window, hotly pursued by me, also leaping out the window, over the neighbour's fence, pursued by his teacher, Dr. Clark, and ran in the back door of the neighbour's through, which was open, through the kitchen into a lounge and started pulling out all her books, trying to read and access, you know, the reading material. And because I was in hot pursuit, and I remember running past this poor woman in her kitchen wondering what on earth was going on, I just said, I'm sorry, I'll explain, as I ran through the house chasing my boy. But that, I guess there is a serious side to that, because sometimes Patrick and I've known other children who display quite exceptional savant skills. They don't necessarily, they haven't got the understanding about danger and risk. Mm-hmm. And Patrick, again, you know, would often run across roads, highways without mm-hmm. looking. Mm-hmm. So he would actually put his life in danger mm-hmm. trying to get to his savant interests or pursuit. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I do think, and, you know, we rated, looked at the children's behaviour mm-hmm. using the famous developmental mm-hmm. behaviour checklist. Developed by our own Australian researchers. Yep. And, you know, without doubt, all the children in my study did kind of have slightly higher levels yep. of challenging behaviour yep. than other children on yep. the spectrum. So yep. that's just one example. Yep. But I think when you analyse it down, sometimes I think these children are bored. Yep. You know, their peer group in my class were actually very severely affected children on the spectrum. Very high support needs, and mm-hmm. some of them are, you know, quite high levels of intellectual delay. So Patrick was bored.
Yeah. I would add to that as well. As well as the savant skill, there's the passionate interest. Now, I would understand that not for all savant skill people, maybe their savant skills aren't their passionate interest. But if they are, the idea of running across the road to get to it, I mean, for an autistic person, that special interest, that passion is... Yeah. It's overriding. I know this. I mean, this is the reason I spend 90 hours a week doing my paid work and this kind of work, which is ridiculous. And people say, how on earth can you do all that? So, well, it's not work. This is what I love. But if someone's thing that they love involves needing to put themselves at risk or something, it's an overriding passion that can be really difficult to actually get past. But if that's actually someone's high level of skill and ability, I would imagine that compounds the issue somewhat, that it can, you have to be really careful to make sure someone's kept safe and you know, actually understands the consequences of yes. things like that.
And I agree. And I think, you know, for children who are identified on the spectrum with these skills, you know, again, to me, it's another reason for them to be taken seriously mm-hmm. and that, you know, teachers and parents, you know, look at ways, how can we actually help our young children to make use of these skills, yes. you know, in a productive way for the children themselves. So, yeah.
No, that's good. Another thing that I think you touched on before, but what sorts of issues do parents of kids in this group come up against? What sorts of problems do they find?
Okay, other than, I guess, sometimes, as we just said, you know, having children on the spectrum who may have even, you know, higher levels mm. of challenging behaviour because of their, you know, passions. Mm. In the past, they were referred to sometimes as obsessive behaviours.
Mm. I avoid that language.
Yes, no, and I think passionate is a much more appropriate term. I fully agree. It describes passion. And again, I guess when I was doing a lot of my background reading, Jeanette, I actually read in the field of non-disabled achievement, mm-hmm. prodigies, what makes great achievement. And without doubt, it's that passion. Mm-hmm. It's that passion, number one, and it rides right through. No matter who have been our prodigies in the world and our history, it's that interest. And again, that someone... often has mentored them, allowed them to go forward and engage in their passion, has equaled high achievement. To me, it's exactly the same with children on the spectrum. You know, they need access to the passion, and if, you know, people, you know, differentiate, put in the right supports for them, I think great things can happen.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. That sort of brings me to the next question quite nicely. So I've heard this description a long time ago when I first started out in my autism advocacy journey many years ago. I heard savant skills for people with significant support needs described as so what skills. And what that meant was it meant that while the person has extraordinary abilities in one area, they are not living a fulfilled life and the skills aren't actually helping them much in any practical sense, at least as can be observed by an outsider. What are your thoughts about this one?
I guess, you know, historically that was the view, Jeanette, you know, these skills when they were identified. And if you actually look back in the literature, you know, generally probably more the field of psychology, clinical psychology and psychiatry has spent decades poring over this topic of savant skills, really. And I guess their passion has been trying to understand where on earth do these skills appear from? Because quite often they do appear when the children are very young. And, you know, what my study showed and supports the literature, that it's not the result of teaching by a teacher or a parent. You know, often these skills, they're on set. Children in my study, I had 24 children, spectrum. The average age of onset was 2.5 years, which is extraordinarily young. So I guess the view was that these skills have no practical value, they are useless, so what skills? I guess my message is very different. It's actually saying, just a moment, these children are displaying sometimes, and this is where Daryl Treffert's definition of savant syndrome, he talks about there's different levels. Level one, he would call a skill, savant skill that stands in contrast to the child or the student's peer group in terms of their developmental level of functioning, but they're also level two skills, which are at the prodigious level, so way beyond the performance of any non-disabled person or adult. So many of these children have displayed these prodigious savant skills, and I guess the challenge for parents and teachers is to try and support the practical functional application of those skills. And to be honest, that was one of the main rationales or reasons behind my study, and we did achieve it for many children. We got a significant difference over a 2-year period in their functional use of some of those skills. So, you know, I'm happy to have that debate with anyone, even if it's in a boxing ring, about these skills are just, you know, are wasted, so what skills? Because my view is the complete opposite.
Well, you'll really like this example from my real life, not from me. I don't have any savant skills, but I have a friend who has savant skills in music. So if you give her any musical instrument and leave it with her for a couple of days, she will master it. And I don't just mean she will work out how to play it. She will master it. She is absolutely off the scale, savant skills, genius, whatever you like. She's a wonderful person and she has significant support needs, but that doesn't actually impact. Well, it impacts, but it doesn't mean that those skills that she have are wasted. I mean, she's amazing. You know, I admire her a lot. And the music skills are, yes, they're prodigious. And she tutors people with music. So it's actually, it's completely against that stereotype. And I think the stereotype is difficult because it's pervasive. And you see a film, I'm sure you've heard this a lot, a film like Rain Man, and that becomes the stereotype. That becomes the assumption that, oh, well, if you have savant skills, you must be really high support needs and have no actual. And the other thing there, which is a real assumption and a stereotype, is that people with high support needs don't have fulfilled lives. I mean, really? I know quite a few people that do, and it just means it's difficult, but yes.
And Jeanette, that again, you know, probably is the message I, you know, convey or attempt to convey in my book.
Yeah.
You know, it's these skills, and it's very interesting because, you know, many professionals in the field of autism, and you would know this, Jeanette, you know, are consumed with, you know, working on the deficits, of children and adults, young adults on the spectrum,
yeah.
you know, with the AIDS, that one day it'll all be gone and they'll all be wonderful, yeah. you know, neurotypical adults, you know, employed 40 hours
yeah.
a week,
yeah.
you know, happily married, you know, the house, car, you know, whatever, yeah. whatever that dream is, yeah. I'm not sure. I don't quite understand what that is.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because really it's about living a happy life.
Yeah.
And I guess having written this book, studied this topic for many years, worked with savants, then my conclusion at the end of it was that these skills really we should facilitate, help people on the spectrum to use them so they can have a happy life, and it's nothing to do with employment. If that's a consequence, that's just fantastic. But it's actually about using those skills in their leisure time to engage socially and just be passionate about. And, you know, I would say everyone, no matter if you have a disability, you have autism, you're neurotypical, whatever term you want, really all we want in life is to be happy and live a fulfilled life. And
I think
you've just described your friend as doing exactly that, and she's an exceptional music savant ability, which is just great.
Yeah, and I think it's really important, not just autistic people, or even not autistic people so much, but people generally reconsider what is success. You know, because for me, you're going about success, well, I know people that have the big house and the family and the professional job and the shiny car in the drive or the shiny couple of cars in the drive. They are miserable. They are not happy. And I know people that are really poor and don't work and they're actually doing okay because they can't work at that point in life. And so apart from dwelling on that and saying, oh, no, they think, well, what can I do instead? And they have a think about what their journey is going to be and find something more useful. So I think we really have to rethink this model of success we have, because for people on the autism spectrum, of course, this becomes really fraught, and we're basically told if we don't fit all these norms, if we don't have a partner or kids or whatever, then we're not fulfilled. Well, what a load of rubbish. I don't have a partner. I'll never have a partner. I'm aromantic. I don't want to go out with anyone. It's not something I want to do. I have a really strong relationship with friends, family, and my cat, and that's, I don't need a partner and kids. I've got other connectedness, so we do need to think about those things, not just around autism but around human beings, I guess.
Yes, it's a whole concept, isn't it, you know, of society and what is normal, normalization. It's a pursuit, you know, that we've sort of, you know, we are born into these worlds where, you know, that's the pursuit of normalization to be, I'm not quite sure what that is, but, you know, and again, you know, this is a great example, and I think you mentioned just before, Jeanette, about, you know, the view that, you know, people may have thought that, you know, it's people like Rain Man only that display these skills. Yeah. But again, the more recent literature and the study I did actually highlighted that, you know, these skills are evident right across the whole range of cognitive performance and functioning.
Yeah.
So you've got very bright, you know, people like yourself that might move into the twice exceptional gifted range to people who do suffer quite severe levels of intellectual delay but present with these savant abilities. So you're dead right. It's across the whole spectrum and it's not restricted one group or another.
No. And the whole idea that people who need support workers and stuff can't work or can't do all those things is actually not very useful either, because I, in my own life, and I only know a small percent of the humans in the world, but I know a fair number of people who don't, you know, don't speak with verbal language and don't and need support and stuff like that, but they've actually used their skills to be employed and to do those things that most people say that's normal. And it's like we need to move beyond this very narrow view of what you're meant to do.
Absolutely, I agree. And also the very narrow view I think that we've had in a way, and inadvertently, in our working and supporting people on spectrum, you know, it really has been deficit-based, and it's now time. Let's move step forward with our young people and adults and, you know, look at the very positive, the strengths.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always have to be a high strength, high performance, but it's the interest. We've all got an interest, and everyone has. Even our very severely high support needs people have an interest in something, and it might be quite small, but it's up to us to try and, you know, find what those interests are and then support our people, you know, to develop them further.
This brings us to the I sound a bit like Stephen Fry, and I'm not doing QI, I'm doing IQ. So, IQ tests.
Program, Jeanette, for you.
I would love to have that program. I don't think I'd be anywhere near as good as Stephen Fry, but I would have lots of fun. But IQ tests, I've always had issues with IQ tests. I won't go into that because I'd be here for a long time and you wouldn't get to talk about it. So I'll ask you what your thoughts are on IQ tests being used as a measure of intellect and potential. Are they an effective way to test intelligence, do you think?
In a word, no. It's not my belief. I'm not a psychologist. It is not my, major kind of area of skill and knowledge. But, I guess I came to that insight, my first few years of teaching children on the spectrum that, I have taught prior to that children with, Down syndrome, different levels of intellectual delay, moderate, very severe intellectual delay. And I have to say my view, which is probably why the title of my book, Exploring Giftedness and Autism, I think there is a difference across all of those on the spectrum. My sense is IQ tests fail. Our people, they are not a true record of their true level of ability. And probably I prefer that word ability than intelligence. It's interesting, Jeanette, because I'm right beside me on my desk. I have an edited chapter that I'm co-authoring for a brand new book by Rutledge. It'll come out later this year, and I'm not doing a marketing here. I'm just trying to make about IQ. Yeah. I was asked to write a chapter on twice exceptional students on the spectrum. I guess, they may have come across, a recent book about savants. I've, just received it back from the editors for, the first rewrite, and I've got a wonderful co-author on it.
Yeah.
But even in that, when I'm stepping just into the field of gifted education, there are problems with IQ testing.
Yeah.
And, I've tried to make this point. I'm like the, I'm not quite sure how I'm perceived, but, I get invited to talk at gifted conferences generally. And sometimes, I feel like I'm going to be stoned or, held from the theatre because, often I say, but just a minute, if you're looking at the full range of giftedness, you can't just be looking at an IQ cutoff point. There are many, many children in schools who are extremely gifted, across every domain, drawing and sculpting and tech drawing, etc. And they don't fit the normal definition of giftedness because it's IQ based. But in the field, even in the field of gifted ed, non-disabled gifted children have problems with IQ testing, and there are debates in that field. But in the field of autism, there are non-verbal intelligence tests that, without fail, our children generally perform a lot better, on tests that isn't language loaded or based. So, I look forward to the day when we can look at other ways of measuring strength, interest and ability rather than IQ tests.
Yeah, I have major concerns about, and I'm not an expert in the field, but I still have major concerns around how the IQ scores are used. Now, what needs to change in the world to help autistic people with savant skills and giftedness achieve their potential?
I guess first and foremost, Jeanette, it's education and awareness. I think, the whole discussion we're having today is still quite new. I'm not sure if it is in other countries. I'm about to find out because I'm delighted I'm doing a paper at the upcoming International Meeting for Autism Research in San Francisco.
Oh, well done.
But after that, I'm spending time across in Wisconsin with Daryl Treffert. There's a big new Treffert Centre named in his honour. I'm actually going to be talking. I've been invited to speak to his staff at the centre. And I guess my message is really about educating people because it is still fairly new that we talk about people being gifted or twice exceptional in autism. And I must say what I've learned by stepping in the field of gifted education, in some ways their work is more advanced than us in the field of autism.
Yeah.
They've been using that term, gifted, disabled, researching, exploring it for 20 years, 20, 30 years, and my feeling is we're only just beginning to look at this, you know, truly in the field of autism. And I must say that Patricia Howland in 2009, Pat Howland is known to, you know, many people in the field. Pat Howland did a prevalence study with adults on the spectrum. And this is the very recent, most recent study on prevalence. And they estimated, and I also have to say for those who have been around for many years, Michael Rutter also was part of her research team. They determined it was close to 30% of the adults in their study displayed savant skills. Now, that's a big number. So I think we need to educate people. There are many more people who display their special skills who have autism. Number two, it's we need to, particularly schools, preschools, we need to add in, we need to focus on those special abilities and infuse them into the child's education program. In the field of gifted education, they call it differentiating the curriculum. So it's most children who have a disability or autism, mainstream or special education services will have an individual education plan.
Yeah.
So what we need teachers and parents is to look at how do you actually build in their savant memory skill, their savant calendar skill, their music, artistic skill as part of their education program that, you know, may be able to be applied and assist them, you know, as they grow into adults and in their post-school years. So, and I think one of the major strategies, I'm going on, I apologise, Jeanette, what I also learned from my study looking at the literature is the great value of people on the spectrum and those with savant skills having a mentor. So, you know, if somebody's got an exceptional writing skill or engineering skill, computers, IT, my advice is parents and teachers find a mentor to work, support that child as they grow. And you'll be interested to know, hopefully, that's exactly the key strategy in the field of gifted education is mentors. And again, as I said before, most prodigies, high achievers in life, when you read their case histories, read over their lives, they were mentored by the one, two, three exceptional people. Identified the skills, saw their potential and helped them, supported them.
I'm totally with you on the mentoring thing. I find it really funny when people get all intimidated and insecure about people that are more, you know, have achieved stuff or that might have more influence or something. And I just think about that in my life and I think throughout my adult life, I have found and attached myself to and befriended influential people doing good things so that I can learn from them. And it just seems completely counter to my understanding of life to feel jealous or intimidated of someone. You think, well, they're the expert. I need to learn about this. So I'm just going to see if I can pick their brains for a bit. And you know what? Most people that I've approached or that even I haven't had to approach because they've approached me have been really happy to do that. I'm happy to do that. If people, some people these days want to pick my brains, I'm very generous about that because I won't be here forever. The more of us there are, the better. You know, it's just so I think always if you think someone, you would like someone to be your mentor, then ask them, befriend them. It's a good thing to do.
100%. And, you know, as we started this interview, why did you write the book? Well, there were those three people I mentioned, Temple Grandin and Daryl Trefford, Miracle Gross, who were exceptional people, who exactly that. They saw my interest and mentored, you know, guided me and, dare I say, pushed me to get on and take the time and, you know, put the words down. That becomes a resource for others. So I agree 100%.
And one last question, very important. Where can people buy the book?
The book, again, I'm not sure exactly what outlets. I know the New University of New South Wales bookshop carries it, but just go to the Routledge website or alternatively Taylor and Francis. Taylor and Francis are the actual publisher. Routledge is owned by the Taylor and Francis Group. It's available through Taylor and Francis Group in Melbourne. So just Google either Routledge or Taylor and Francis and you can order the book through there.
And yes. I will put a link to that on the promo page for this show. So if you're listening to the show, just click on the page in Blog Talk Radio and there'll be a link there to where you can get the book. So thank you very much, Trevor. It's been really interesting talking to you. I'm so glad I got you on the show. And people right. should read the book if that's of relevance or interest, because it's good. And, yeah, thank you, Mr. Kitty. You may have noticed me on the Skype there, Trevor, making sort of mouthing painful sounds because he bit me, but he wanted my attention, and apparently talking to the computer is not good.
Not good enough, Jeanette.
Not good. I better go give him some attention.
It's my pleasure. I'm delighted to speak to you, and thank you again for the invite.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Trevor.
Best. Thanks, Jeanette.
Bye.
Dogs are going ballistic.